Thank you, Ernesto. It's great fun to be here, both because it is a focaccia workshop and also because it is PI. I was a postdoc here at PI, and I remember that very, very fondly. Yeah, and so I'm very happy to be back. Yeah, this morning I was greeted by Sarah with the words, "Oh, you have the first talk." And I thought, oh, that's a really nice joke to greet a physics prof with. But then John said the same, and then I started worrying about it. So indeed, I had the first talk, but I was not ready. I wanted to prepare it last week. Then all sorts of stuff intervened. I couldn't do anything at all. So I was working over the weekend. I was working in the airplane, and I was working this morning. Still, I wasn't ready. So I got 2 additional hours granted. And now I have all the slides together. But never looked at them, so I might be surprised what's on them. And I'm in danger of going over time, obviously. So, well, I'll try. So why am I so keen to give this talk? It's the first time I give it. Oh, I forgot to say, this is joint work with Paulina Feldmann from UBC and Chian Ukai from Bill Kent. Why am I so keen to give this talk? Yeah, so this is from a workshop last September in London. This workshop was in honor of Samson Abramsky, who is also here in the audience. And Samson was speaking at this workshop, and he spoke about how science is a community enterprise. And so that the community spirit is needed to make progress in science. And maybe when he spoke, he said something slightly stronger than that. I think he also said working in small groups and in groups that come from different angles is necessary to make progress in science. And within an hour, he got his wish granted. Within an hour. So this was Samson speaking, then Rui was speaking, Rui Barbosa, who is unfortunately not here in person today, but he's online, I hear. So Rui spoke after him, and then after Samson's and Rui's talk, this discussion happens. So this is Mai Gerke. She's from another community. She's a mathematician. The lattice theory corner, lattices like in Birkhoff von Neumann compounds, that sort of stuff. And she figured out that there is a connection to what Samson was speaking about, and she's bringing her angle in. Yeah, and that gave rise to this discussion. And I want to get back to this discussion. We think that we have something to say about it too, and I simply want to make our pitch. I want to kind of contribute to this and see how it works out with the ways the others involved here are thinking about the subject. Okay, yeah, so what I'll be talking about is the MBQC, that stands for Measurement-Based Quantum Computation, Contextuality Cohomology Triangle. And so I'll tell you what this is shortly, but my talk will have 2 parts. So this triangle is established in a limit. So when this is about measurement-based quantum computation, and the limit it is established in is when the temporal order is flat. So the whole computation can be done in a single step. That's not always the case. It's not generically the case. And so what we do today is to generalize this triangle to the properly temporally ordered case. So that is the new part that I'm going to present to you. The temporally flat case is the review part. Yeah? And this is what my talk consists of, these 2 parts. Okay, so what is a triangle about? Yeah, so a question we might ask is, the Boolean algebra is a very basic thing in the theory of classical computation, and so we ask, what is the counterpart to that in quantum mechanics? We don't really know an answer to this question, but Mermenstar is an example for such an algebraic structure. It is related to quantum computation, specifically measurement-based quantum computation that was figured out by Jeanette Anders and Dan Brown. It is, of course, in the first place, a proof of contextuality, so that's how it is quantum mechanical. And it is described by cohomology. So you have quantum computation, quantum mechanical resource, mathematical description, all nicely put together, combined. And so the ambiguity, contextuality, cohomology triangle is just an attempt to generalize the situation. So this is what the talk's going to be about. Okay, so yeah, Merman star. I mean, I'm just kind of, I'm flashing things that I believe most of you will know. I will not explain Merman star to you and how it is a contextuality proof. I hope that it will pretty well known here in the community. Let me make a check. Who has heard of Merman star, or who knows what Merman star is and how it works? Okay, I see that it works sort of. It's about, I think, half of the audience has raised their hands. Yeah, okay, so let me just say a little bit about it. So this is an arrangement of observables, 10 observables in 5 contexts. Every observable appears in exactly 2 contexts, and these observables are of Pauli type, on 3 qubits. Well, within each line here, they are such that they commute and multiply to the identity plus minus sign. And yeah, I think that's probably all that is to say about these observables. And so it turns out if you think you can assign a value to these observables, you run into an algebraic contradiction. You got a linear system of equations that is in such a way that it doesn't have a solution. Good. Probably doesn't help you that much if you haven't seen it before. Apologize for that. Okay, so the Merman star is the central example for the review part of my talk. Yeah? It has no temporal order, but otherwise it very nicely illustrates the connection between contextuality and measurement-based quantum computation. Okay, so now let's begin with the review part. So what I'll do here is I go through this triangle kind of first through the vertices, then through the edges, and then the triangle all together. So let's get started. Measurement-based quantum computation. So this is a scheme of quantum computation that doesn't operate by unitary gates, but instead by projective measurements. So you apply these measurements to some resource state, and that can be always the same state. There's universal resource states. So information is written onto these states and processed and read out from these states again by 1-qubit measurements alone. Yeah, it's a universal scheme of quantum computation. It's very closely related to the circuit model in that way. Okay, so I hope that you have some preliminary understanding, varying degree about this computational model. So this is the model we will be referring to today. Okay, so now measurements in quantum mechanics have random outcomes, and this randomness needs to be dealt with in this computational scheme. So there's 2 things that you need to do. I mean, you want to computational outcome that is not completely random. And so this is extracted from correlations of the individual measurement outcomes. Yeah, the computational result is extracted from correlations of measurement outcomes. So that's one thing for which you need a classical processing in measurement-based quantum computation. And there is another reason you need it, and that is adaptation of measurement bases. So measurement bases and some qubits depend on measurement outcomes at other qubits. So this measurement basis over here may depend on measurement outcomes over here to the left. And that is the reason why you have temporal order in measurement-based quantum computation. That is why, even though the measurements commute, you cannot implement them all at the same time. Good, and I want to illustrate how this temporal order comes about. This will be important for what we see later. Okay, so here you see measurement-based quantum computation in the simplest example you could think of on a 3-qubit cluster state arranged in a chain. So what this circuit simulates is a general SU2 unitary decomposed in its Euler form, Z rotation, X rotation, Z rotation, the whole thing applied to initial superposition of 0 and 1, and then measured in the X basis. Okay, so this is what you can simulate with it, but this is not actually what you do. So here is where the effect of the measurement outcomes comes in. So, well, you do implement your, so let's think about the measurement here of the first qubit. It does implement the intended unitary, but then there's the effect of the measurement outcome. Depending on whether this outcome is 0 or 1, eigenvalue plus 1 or minus 1, you get an additional Pauli rotation sigma z, or you don't get it. So this is the thing that you get in addition, and that happens for each simulated gate. You always have these byproducts, we call them, and you don't really want them, but they are there, so you need to deal with them. So you get, you need to, and you deal with them by getting rid of them, by propagating them forward in time. And when you propagate them, you know, by the XZ commutation relation, what happens is that these rotation angles flip, and so you need to adapt the measurement basis to accommodate that change in rotation angle. Yeah, and so you propagate them forward, you propagate them past the final measurement where they don't do any harm anymore. So this is how you get rid of these random Paulis again. Yeah, but then, okay, so this leads to the adaption of measurement bases, but also it affects the readout. So this sigma z here affects the readout like this one does, and so you need to take those into account also when you output your computational result. Yeah, and this is what I just said in words amounts to these relations. Okay, so yeah, this is how temporal order gets into measurement-based quantum computation, and this talk is about temporal order, so I thought I elaborate that a little bit. Okay, contextuality. So this ends my review of measurement-based quantum computation. So now I progress to contextuality, and you know, contextuality is very prominent in Focaccia, so I don't need to say anything about it. I assume that you know what the hidden variable model is and that quantum mechanics doesn't work like this. It's the content of the quotient-Speckle theorem. What I want to say here in this review of contextuality is that Merriman-Starr, which I already introduced, has a state-dependent version. And the connection to measurement-based quantum computation goes through this state-dependent version, so I mentioned it here. Yeah, okay, so we have one of the five contexts now representing a quantum state. It's a Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger state. And the reason we use that state is that the observables here in this horizontal context, they stabilize that state. Namely, the Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger state is an eigenstate of them. And so the values you have here, they are now simply the eigenvalues of that state with respect to those observables. So now these four observables for sure have values, deterministic values. Okay, and now you ask, can you assign values to the remaining observables? You still can't because you only made the problem harder by fixing the values here. So you had no solution before, you will have no solution now. Okay. All right, but we will turn this into a measurement-based quantum computation very soon. So Anders and Brown showed us how to do it. Okay, so this is what I say for contextuality right now. I assume you are familiar with the concept. Okay, so now it gets really, really sketchy. So now I'm reviewing homology and cohomology, and I'm doing not the least bit of justice to the subject at all, so I'm giving you these slides simply to remind you what to load into your working memory. So I presume you studied this at some point. Okay, so what is this about? Homology, so what we see here is a geometrical object. It's a surface, and this we call it F, and the surface has a boundary. So surfaces have boundaries, and they are line-like. Okay, the boundary of a boundary is empty. So yeah, so you had the surface had a boundary, but the boundary itself has no boundary. Okay, so this is an important fact about homology. Next, okay, here you have another bound. So this is the question of whether the reverse of the previous statement is also true, and it's not. So here you have a cycle, some chain that has no boundary, and we can ask, is it just because of that property, is it itself the boundary of some surface? And it is not. Yeah? It is not. So this chain, even though it doesn't have a boundary, it is not the boundary of something. Okay. So these were all facts about homology. So now one about cohomology, kind of similar thing. Okay, so you have some field. Well, this looks like an electric field. And if it is the gradient of some potential, then the curl of that field is zero. Yeah, and that's just on the cohomology side, the similar fact than what we had before. So the curl of a gradient, that is the double co-boundary of some scalar field, vanishes. Okay, just kind of hopefully this is enough to remind you of this area. Good. Now this has completed the vertices in our review. Now let's talk about two edges. I will talk about the connection between measurement-based quantum computation and contextuality. That's the first. And then between cohomology and contextuality. Okay. And even though, please ask questions. I don't know how the previous talks were. I was sitting in the cafe finishing my slides, but please interrupt me whenever you have a question. Okay, so connection between contextuality and measurement-based quantum computation. So I need to say one thing about the hidden variable model that we use here. So the hidden variable model, what we want to show is that we cannot use a hidden variable model to describe measurement-based quantum computation in certain regimes, and I get to that. And so I need to explain what the hidden variable model is for, what it is supposed to describe. The hidden variable model is supposed to describe all the measurements that can be performed in a given measurement-based quantum computation. Yeah? So there are the measurement bases are at these angles that are characteristic of a certain given computation, but then earlier measurements flip these angles. So you have two measurement bases for each site. Huh? So you have two local observables that your hidden variable model says has predetermined values. So these observables are in the model. They are all local, but there is a distinction to a standard hidden variable model here, and that is in measurement-based quantum computation, you have communication between the qubits for the adjustment of measurement bases. This is not in accordance with a local hidden variable model, and so here's the model that we study. So we say, quantum mechanically, it goes like this. Resource state is prepared, the value of the input is chosen for the quantum computation, and then the computation is run and output is produced. And so the way we model this on the hidden variable model side is when the resource is prepared, the hidden variable model is fixed and stays fixed. And then the input is chosen, but at that point, the hidden variable model is fixed. And then instead of running the actual computation, the hidden variable model is probed. And then the question is, can this model predict the computational outcome? Okay, so I wanted to say this first. So this is our notion of hidden variable model. And now, I want to go into the connection. I want to begin with the particular and then move on to the more general. As I said probably several times by now, the connection was discovered by Anders and Brown. Yeah, and so the state-dependent Merman stalk computes. We have one context given for the state. This is the resource state in this computation, and the remaining four contexts are labeled by the input of the computation. So we have two bits of input, and it turns out there's one bit of output, and it computes an OR gate. So this is a little bit embarrassing. We are computing an OR gate in quantum. Ooh. But there's a fundamental point about it, and that point is this is a nonlinear function on the inputs, and the classical side processing relations are all linear. So we are getting something out that is more than what we put in, even though it is still very little. So there is this fundamental point to make, and the fact that we can output a nonlinear function is precisely reflecting this feature of contextuality. So the algebraic contradiction of a hidden variable model turns into something useful, namely the computation of something slightly more complicated than what we put in. Yeah. Okay. So maybe that's what I want to say about it. Now the more general statement. So there's now theorems 1 to 3. They all say the same thing in more general scenario. So the theorem 1 speaks to the contextuality of measurement-based quantum computation. It says, a measurement-based quantum computation that deterministically computes a nonlinear Boolean function is contextual. And this, is contextual as long as it deterministically computes a nonlinear Boolean function. So no reference to what the resource state here is or what the function is, completely general. So what you might not like about this theorem is the word deterministic, because most quantum computations are probabilistic. So yeah, there's indeed a refinement. There's two refinements, in fact. So yeah, so now it turns out you don't need to be deterministic. You can be probabilistic. And there is and still contextual if you pass a certain success probability threshold, and that threshold depends on details of the nonlinear function computed, namely on the distance to the closest linear function. Yeah? So for the bent function, this threshold is very small. It's above a tiny bit above 1/2, but for other nonlinear functions can be very close to 1. Okay. So this is the result for the probabilistic case, and you can refine this even more. This is a result by Abramsky and company. Yeah, sorry, I forgot to quote it properly. I already told you I was a little bit in a rush. So here, okay, so this is just the application to a Merman's star, but let's skip that. So now here is a more general version of this result. You can invoke the contextual fraction. Namely, the larger the contextual fraction, that is, the more contextual your system is, the less of a constraint you have. So this is the full quantum case. This is the classical case. So this is the theorem we saw before. And then there is a line where the threshold is parameterized by the contextual fraction. Good. All right, so this is the general result we know. Good. Okay. It's so quiet here. Just kind of please interrupt me if you like. Good.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean to compute?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so let's see where that was. Oh. Yeah. Yeah, okay, maybe I don't, yeah. This picture is good enough. Thank you very much for this question. So this is the work of Anders and Brown. So you have two bits of inputs by which, or let me see, there is a, because I've been talking about these linear site processing relations, so maybe I find them. Yeah, I think this is the better slide. Has a little bit more information. So, so we have these, I told you, we have these linear site processing relations of quantum computation. So these relations here, they choose the measurement bases, whether you measure like this or like that. I mean, in this case, it's the X or the Y bases. So you, for the first qubit, it's determined by the first bit of input. For the second qubit, it's determined by the second bit of input. Third qubit by the sum of the two. But all are linear relations. So you choose the measurement basis this way, and the output, again, is a linear relation of the measurement outcomes. Yeah, so this is how you get your computational output. So now let's verify that. So let's look at the GHZ state. It is an eigenstate of this with eigenvalue plus one and an eigenstate with eigenvalue minus one for the other three observables. And so eigenvalue minus one for us is computational outcome one, and eigenvalue plus one is computational outcome zero. So let's choose input zero, zero. Zero, zero, so the measurement basis is x for all the qubits. So we measure the three x's. Yeah, and the because the observables multiply to the identity, from those measurement outcomes, we can predict the outcome of this, which is guaranteed to be eigenvalue plus one, so it's going to be outcome zero. No? So this is what we're going to report by way of this relation. So now for all the other three contexts, we end up predicting an eigenvalue minus one, which means computational outcome one, and this is how we get the OR. Yeah, good. So much for an explanation. It's kind of typical for measurement-based quantum computation. Good. Yeah. Other questions? Oh, so quiet. Come ask me. Okay, anyway, thank you for helping me getting two-thirds through my talk. Okay, so I think this is almost the last item on the review part. So what we now do, and this doesn't have a reference here, it is from a paper that's now a couple of years old with Stephen Bartlett and Shihan Okai. Yeah, good. So we take this and make it into a chain complex. So whatever was a context here is becoming a face like this. Yeah? And so the GHZ state becomes this face in the center. So Merman's star is converted into a chain complex. Okay, and then now I need to tell you a little bit about reasoning about reasoning in these chain complexes. So let's consider faces like this. So I'll be taking a triangular face to simplify this a little bit. So there's now the following objects that live on these faces. So on the edges, we have observables and then value assignments. If we assert the existence of a hidden variable model, there are values assigned to these observables. In the face lives a function of that face, or we would say a two cochain, beta. Yeah? And so the observables on the edges, they satisfy the following relation. So this is how they are chosen. There's one observable for every edge, and their product multiplies to the identity modulo sine factor that comes from beta. And furthermore, because this is a contextuality, the observables on the three edges have to pairwise commute. Okay, so beta contains all the relevant information about these contexts of observables. So beta, as I already said, just by definition is a cocain, but it is actually a 2-co cycle. I'm not going to show that here. So, and it turns out, so this will be the end of the argument, if beta is cohomologically non-trivial, that means beta is inequivalent to any co-boundary, then the corresponding setting is contextual. Okay, so this, I'm just mentioning this right now to show you where we are getting to, but I have to prove that to you. Okay, so let's do that. Okay, so yeah, so if we assert the existence of a hidden variable model, then this operator relation is converted to that relation among the value assignments. Yeah? Every observable now has a value assignment, and this relation holds, modulo 2. Okay, and you can rewrite this as that. If this holds now for every face, then altogether we are getting this relation, beta equals the co-boundary of our asserted value assignment. Yeah, and if beta cannot be written in this form, then our situation is contextual. No value assignment exists. Okay, so that is the connection. Okay, so let's do this in the present scenario. So in this scenario, beta is zero everywhere. All right. Then we have beta is zero everywhere, and I should say, if we take this face as a whole, it has no boundary. And the reason is that this edge is identified with that edge up here. This edge is identified with that edge over there. So there's really no boundary. So, all right. So we will use this shortly. So beta is zero everywhere in this case, so the integral of beta over the surface is zero. But we can write this as follows. So now, assuming that the value assignment exists, this equals that, yeah, beta equals ds. But that can be written as the value of s over the boundary of the surface. Oh dear, I apologize, I said the surface has no boundary, that was a mistake. The surface only covers these faces, so this face is not included here. Yeah. So there is a boundary, which is the red line. Yeah? It also says that here. Okay, so it's the integral of the boundary over the values we have here, and this equals one. So this is a contradiction, and so that inference must have been wrong. Good. Okay, I'm totally running out of time. Let me just, I'm just completing, yeah, it's probably going to be like that. I'll be just completing the review, and then I will have time for the essential thing that is new in the construction. Okay, so what can we do? Let me just go right through the summary, to the summary of this recap. I was a little bit brief in the last part, but I need to be. So, so maybe I explained that. When we want to apply this to computation, this cohomological calculus, what we do is we contract the chain complex. So we had a bunch of edges here that had values assigned, and we just contract those, and then add the values to the beta functions. So as you see here. Yeah? So now the beta functions become non-trivial, and they contain now the computational output of our scenario. All right. And now, with a little bit of skipping things, so this beta for this contracted complex, beta psi is still a co-cycle. And well, beta psi contains the computed function. Its co-cycle class is a contextuality witness and is also a witness for the nonlinearity of the computed function. So this is the cohomological picture of a measurement-based quantum computation and contextuality in it. The problem with this is that everything here is temporarily flat. There is no mention of temporal order. And so in this remaining time, of which there is unfortunately not very much, I want to tell you how we have begun to solve this. So this is about the temporal order case. And I explained the temporally flat case with a characteristic example. There was a GHZ state. And now there's going to be another generic example. And this is the 1D cluster state. So the difference is, if you think of what you can do with the GHZ state as a resource, in terms of gates, it is commuting rotations, all rotations about the z-axis. Here in this case, z rotations and x rotations alternate, and this is how temporal order comes in. They don't commute. Just, okay, so that's why the 1D cluster state is a good example. I must go through this by example because of time, and even then. Anyway, so I thought, so this is the minimal point that I wanted to get to in my talk. I wanted to tell you what the new ingredient is that we use to make this work for temporally ordered computations. So previously, our phases looked like this. We had the observables, we had eigenvalues, if we asserted the hidden variable model, a value assignment, and then we had this two co-cycle beta. Okay, and now we have an additional object, a projector. Okay, and maybe since I have a bit of time, I explain to you what changes and what these objects mean, why we have them there. That is probably what I can still do. So let's go through this list. In the first row, there's no entry here. There's no constraints on these observables individually. Here, there is now a constraint. So we have this projector, and we will shortly figure out what it means. And the observables are in block diagonal form. That is, they satisfy this identity over here. Okay, and this will turn out to be important. That's a new thing. Then, well, the observables had to commute. Now they don't have to commute anymore. They only have to commute on the subspace given by the projector. The observables had to be dependent in this way. They had to multiply to the identity modulo sign. They don't have to do that anymore. They have to do this only on the subspace given by the projector. Okay. The projector is a kind of conditioning, is precisely the conditioning that comes with temporal order and measurement-based quantum computation. I see a half arm. No, you were just stretching? Okay, good. Very, very modest amount of stretching. Good. So now let's talk a little bit about what all this means. So in this triangle, so the triangle describes an individual act of measurement. So we have triangles for all the measurements. Okay, and this is what it looks like. So one edge, one observable is now the local observable that I measure. Yeah, it has a label where it happens and also a time at which it happens, t, and then there is a binary choice here. The measurement can be such or such, means different observables, and that's why you have this label over here. You have other quantities. These are the information flow observable. I mean, you can say this covers your past measurement record. I mean, another way to say it is it describes those byproduct operators, these sigma x's and sigma z. So it tells you which of the, this quantity tells you which byproduct you had two time steps before. Okay, and this is what byproduct you have at the current time t. Okay, so these three operators are related in the fashion previously stated. Okay, so this is what the objects now mean, and you have a conditioning. So the projector corresponds to which of the two observables you measure. Yeah? So if all your prior processing has told you to measure the observable for which the observable QT of zero, then there's a corresponding projector associated with this phase, and likewise for the complementary observable. Good. Okay, so this is what the phase describes. There's two more things to say. One thing to say is that this projector here is also related to this information flow observable at yet another time instant that's between this and that. This instant between, and the relation is as given here. Yeah? So this projector is on the positive eigenstate of this information flow quantity, and this projector is on the negative eigenspace of this information flow quantity. Yeah? And so this is precisely what governs the adjustment of measurement basis. So this is one thing to say. And the other thing to say is that, of course, we don't have just one phase, we have two of them. We have one for each projector. We have one phase such that in the boundary we have either of the two possibly measured observables. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that. And with this, my time is up. Yeah, I'm just kind of clicking through the slides right to the conclusion, and please ask me if you have questions later. Please ask me. So this is what I didn't get to. Okay, so these are the relations of inference. Okay, so there's two complexes. So let's maybe go here. So you see we had this stepping from a certain time to time plus two to time plus four and so on and so forth. So there's a distinction here between even and odd times. And there's two complexes, but they are interlinked. And they are interlinked because of the second last thing that I showed you. So this is the structure that we end up with. Okay, the contextuality proof is iffy. Well, we know what the iffy contextuality proof is thanks to Samson and Kohai Koshida. Yeah, so we have to talk about what, when we now infer a hidden variable model, what it does to the complex. It shrinks the complex, and then with a little bit more time, I could have told you the contextuality proof is the same what it was before. Let me conclude. So open problems, what do we want to do? I mean, first we want to sort this out properly. There's many details to fix. We want to establish connections with symmetry protected topological order, which we know there are. We want to establish connections with the theory of lattices as in Birkhoff von Neumann, and so that's what we are hoping for. This is what Mai Gerke spoke about at the workshop last fall. We want to sort out the duality that I just hinted at briefly, and we want to find large families of these computational structures that generalize Merman's star in that regard that they represent proper temporal order. So we want to find large families of them, and then the question is, can they be enumerated or classified? Yeah, thank you very much.
Questions from the audience?
Yes. So I actually have a question about computational structures. I mean, given that OR is already universal for classical computation, you're just trying to find like more Boolean circuits that would be implemented,
Boolean circuits?
More different Boolean circuits that can be implemented?
So let me say, so let's talk about discrete logarithm. So a discrete logarithm, Mike Mosca is telling me, can be made deterministic. And for Shor's algorithm, the question apparently was open when it was discussed. But anyway, discrete logarithm can be made deterministic. So what computational structure is behind that? Yeah, it would be, broadly speaking, in this domain, and what is it, what can be said about it? That's what we're looking after.
Okay, so would be one example is just making, I guess, Shor's algorithm deterministic or something like that?
I would prefer if somebody already had made that.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
I don't know if there's people here in the audience who can comment on whether it can be made deterministic or not and under what circumstances. But yeah, I mean, if it could be made deterministic, maybe not Dish knows, it would be a nice example or a nice family of examples. But and then the question is, I mean, these are then fairly elaborate things. What structure can we recognize in them?
Questions? Anyone here?
Samson has a question.
Well, could you say just a word about what the duality is referring to?
Yes. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So let's go back. Okay, so maybe let's go back to this picture here. So broadly speaking, I don't know if there's chalk here. Broadly speaking, thank you. No, this is perfect. So so this is one dimension lower. So let me answer this with a toric code because this is a super familiar setting. Huh? So this is in two dimensions. Our complexes on three dimensions. So here, in this 2D setting, every face is dual to a site, and every edge is dual. Well, to a dual edge, edges become edges under the duality. And the same surface code can be described by either lattice. Yeah? And the stabilizer generators directly refer to these lattices. Hmm? Okay, so this duality is what I'm talking about here in 2D. Faces are related to dual sites, and edges are related to dual edges. So in our scenario, the situation is such that faces are related to dual edges, and primal edges are related to dual faces. Yeah, and that is what you see in this picture here. Yeah, and it goes back to this picture. Yeah, so the information flow quantity at this time instance, it is related to this projector by the relation I showed you, but in its own right, it will appear on the left of such a triangle, and that will then be a dual triangle. And here, the primal triangles and the dual triangles are shown together.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the best effort I can make at this moment. Thank you for asking this question.
Do we have questions from the audience online? If so, you can just speak up. Apparently not. I have a quick question, okay?
Yeah.
It's maybe speculative, but you have this paper from 2011 on discrete models for space-time using MBQC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you envisage that this cohomological picture may help in modeling quantum space-time or this kind of idea that you had in this previous paper?
Why did you Why did you even have to mention this paper? We have these quantum gravity people here sitting in this building, and they will mock me for that paper, maybe. So maybe we have scaled back. Maybe let's not talk about how the world operates, but let's maybe confine to measurement-based quantum computation. Although we could. So the usefulness of this paper I regard as follows. So we uncovered a bunch of stuff in there. For example, the temporal order is also related to local complementation. I believe that this paper will be worth re-examining with better techniques and finding better techniques to say the whole thing. So I believe that this whole duality discussion is linked to a certain symmetry that we have discovered back then. I'd be happy to discuss this in the coffee break. Yeah, so this is basically how I see this old paper. This is kind of a package of interesting phenomenology that needs reassessment with better techniques.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Online or here? If not, let's thank Robert again and go for lunch.